Blog Talk Radio.
Center of the world. Latitude zero. Longitude zero. Planned by the Creator. Sosanthropus was the first man found on the earth. That earth was the motherland, Africa. We know that without total understanding of what happened in the past, it would be difficult to relate to the future. We know that within the structure of the music, there should be a message, and the message should be truth. So now, we give you Africa, the center of the world.
First visit to this historical landmark. Our tour through these hallowed halls will be conducted by the First Lady.
Put your hands together. Give us up your good side. And welcome.
right great-great-grandfather killed my great-great-grandfather, and your white great-grandfather sold my great-grandfather, and your white grandfather raped my grandmother, and your father stole, cheated, lied, and robbed my father. What kind of a fool would I have to be to say, come, my friend, to the white daughter and son?
Good evening, America. This is your president. Please listen carefully to the announcement I'm about to make. After careful consideration and research, Vice President Duke, Congress, and myself have concluded that black people have not advanced technologically. Their educational testing scores are on a rapid decline. The vast majority of them are on welfare and producing babies at a faster rate than they can support them, and we will not carry them anymore. We are left with no other choice but to put slavery back into effect. All blacks will report to the designated camps in their area to receive further orders. The only blacks excused will be those serving in the United States military and the police. Any blacks who do not cooperate will be terminated immediately. I repeat, slavery is back in effect.
We are at war! That's what I told you! I know you heard what the president said, and if the nigga don't move, then he's dead. It's time for us to take the stand. Woman to woman and man to man. Blood rushes through your veins, you feel the fear. Who'd have thought that it could happen here? It's the land of the free, home of the brave. The year's 95, you're a slave. When they first hear the news, press play and then rewind and review. But the message is clear and it cuts just like a knife. You don't surrender, they take your life. And I remember the movies my mama used to show me.
What's your name?
Remember the times when they fought and they sold you. We are at war! That's what I told you. That's what I told you.
Outgunned, incompetent, miscommand. They take to your home in Lake Tahoe. Get up, get up. busted them up, Howard.
Paul, you conservatives make a mistake. You can't afford to strangle hope in people.
Without hope, people become dangerous.
No, Howard. You liberals have let them invade our society. You give them jobs, political jobs.
Paul, you missed the point. It's only the smart ones we move up.
That makes it even worse.
Oh, no, we have to move them up. If we leave a smart one in the ghetto, he might develop into a leader against us. But if we raise him up into white society, we neutralize him. He feels compelled to try to act like us. He loses his identity and his racial anger, if he has any. He becomes alien to his brothers. They realize he sold them out and they grow to hate him. He becomes worthless to them and safe for us.
No, thank you. In fact, in his love for the creature comforts, except for his color, he's become one of us.
It's you liberals who have lifted them up, Howard.
Paul, you conservatives make a mistake. You can't afford to strangle hope in people.
Without hope, people become dangerous.
No, Howard, you liberals have let them invade our society. You give them jobs, political jobs.
Paul, you missed the point. It's only the smart ones we move up.
That makes it even worse.
Oh, no, we have to move them up. If we leave a smart one in the ghetto, he might develop into a leader against us. But if we raise him up into white society, we neutralize him. He feels compelled to try to act like us. He loses his identity and his racial anger, if he has any. He becomes alien to his brothers. They realize he sold them out and they grow to hate him. He becomes worthless to them and safe for us.
No, thank you. In fact, in his love for the creature comforts, except for his color, he's become one of us.
Go, 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 shorty. It's your birthday. We gon' party like it's your birthday. We gon' sip a Cardi like it's your birthday. And you know we don't give a fuck, cause that's your birthday. You can find me in the club, bottle full of bub. Mama, I got what you need. If you need to fill a bar, I'm in the having sex, I ain't in the making love. So come give me a hug if you're in the getting rough. You can find me in the club, bottle full of bub. Mama, I got what you need. If you need to fill a bar, I'm in the having sex, I ain't in the making love. So come give me a hug if you're in the getting rough. When I pull up out front, you see the Benz on do. When I roll 20 deep, it's always drama in the club. Now that I roll with Dre, everybody show me love. When you feel like Eminem, you get plenty of groupie love. But homie, ain't nothing changed, roll down, tees up. I see exhibit in the cutting, man, roll them up. You watch how I move, you mistake before I play up here. Been hit with a few, but now I don't walk with a limp. In the hood, in the day, they saying 50, you hot. They like me, I want them to love me like they love pop. But I lay in New York, for sure, to tell you I'm loco. When you playing it, to put the rap game in the choke. So I'm fully focused, man, my money on my mind. Got a meal out the deal, and I'm still in the grind. Now shorty says she feelin' my style, she feelin' my flow. A girl from Woody, they buy, and they ready to go. I'm here, bottle full of bub. Mama, I got what you need, if you need to fill a bar. I'm in the having sex, I ain't in the making love. So come give me a hug, if you're in the getting rough. You can find me in the club, bottle full of bub. Mama, I got what you need, if you need to fill a bar. I'm in the having sex, I ain't in the making love. So come give me a hug, if you're in the getting rough. My flow, my show brought me the dough. That brought me all my fancy things. My crib, my car, my clothes, my shoes. Look on me, I just came up and I ain't changing. You should love it way more than you hate it. Oh, you mad? I trust that you be happy I made it. I'm the cat by the bar, toasting to the good life. Moved out the hood, now you tryna pull me back, guys. My joint get the bumping in the club, it's on. I'm with my eyes, the chick, so she smiles, she gone. Hit the roof on fire, man. Just let it burn up, just talking about money, homie, I ain't concerned. I'ma tell you what bank for me, cause go ahead, switch the style up. And if they hate, then let them hate, them, watch the money pile up. Or we can go upside the head with a bottle of blood. Come on, they know where we be. You can find me in the club, bottle full of blood. Mama, I got what you need, if you need to fill a bar. I'm in the having sex, I ain't in the making love. So come give me a hug, if you're in the getting rough. You can find me in the club, bottle full of blood. Mama, I got what you need, if you need to fill a bar. I'm in the having sex, I ain't in the making love. So come give me a hug, if you're in the getting rough.
Don't try to act like you don't know who we be, neither. We the club on time, the pop, pop off. Shady aftermath.
Yes, 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 we're going to celebrate tonight with a special occasion. And that occasion is your truly brother Africa has just graduated to his 65th birthday. We're going to wish him a happy birthday, and we're going to celebrate tonight like we're supposed to. That is to act dignified and provide our people with the necessary information that they must have in order to move our people forward for that liberation. This is just a special episode for Saturday, July 27th, and we'd like to remind everyone who normally listens to our program on Sunday evenings at 7 p.m. We hope to be on tomorrow, but we've been having problems with our Blog Talk Family Network, and we're still trying to figure a way how we can make this thing work. So bear with us. But in the meantime, tonight, let's spend an hour or so enjoying Brother Africa's celebration as he celebrated his 65th birthday. And we're going to kick some ballistics, kick you some knowledge. And part of some of my partners in crime tonight will be Brother Hakeem from the African Awareness Association and Brother Moses, who with the D.C. Metro Coalition in support of the Cuban Revolution. What we're going to do right now, we're going to bring in Brother Hakeem, let him briefly introduce himself, and then Brother Moses, and then we're going to talk a little bit just about who is Brother Africa, and we'd like to share some critical discussions as it relates to the necessity for us to give the proper information so our people can move forward. This is how we're going to go to the club tonight. So right now, Brother Hakeem, it's always an honor to have you. Welcome to Now in Africa on the Move to a special segment of the 65th anniversary of Brother Africa's birthday. Welcome to Africa on the Move, Brother Hakeem.
Happy 65, Brother Africa, and many, many more to come. My name is Hakeem Kamathi Mushoki, Colonel with African Awareness, and my things are about institution building. One of the things why institution building is so key in the African community is that when we talk about the fundamental changes that sweep in society, many of these changes doesn't bode well for the aspirations of the African people. And as such, we have to devise strategies or tactics in terms of, you know, our longevity in society. Without innovating strategy and tactics in terms of moving forward in society, it complicates our ability to actually exist in society. And so one of the things when we talk about right-wing talking points and we talk about the particular nature in which they're very, very not only condescending but extremely racist toward the African community, we understand that that kind of incipient racism has a very deleterious impact on the longevity of African people in society. So as such, we have to have institutions, organizations to combat not only these talking points, but in fact to combat the things that are actually taking place that are counterproductive in terms of the aspirations of African people. So clearly we got our work cut out for us, and one of the things we have to do first and foremost, we have to acknowledge the reality in terms of, or at least the political reality in terms of the changes that are taking place in society, and not to lose ourselves into believing that if in fact Kamala Harris is a selected president of the United States, somehow that's going to have a material benefit for the masses of people in the society. We have to fundamentally understand that the structures in the society, the capitalist structure, is not predisposed to give a damn about the interests of African people. As such, we've always struggled. We have to continue to struggle. Without strategy and tactic, that struggle becomes that much more difficult. And with that, Brother Africa, I conclude.
Thank you, Brother Hakeem. Next, we're bringing up Brother Moses, who's a member of the D.C. Metro Coalition in solidarity with the Cuban Revolution. We'd like to welcome Brother Moses to a special episode of Africa on the Move as we celebrate the 65th anniversary or birthday of Brother Lee, better known as Brother Africa. Welcome, Brother Moses, to Africa on the Move.
Thank you, Brother Africa, and greetings to everyone within the sound of my voice. Happy birthday, happy birthday, happy birthday. 65 years is no small quest. Certainly, God has been with you down through the years and protected you and brought you through. And so we look to the hills from which cometh our help. So we thank you. We thank you. We thank you. We had a thousand times. We couldn't thank you enough for what you're doing for the people by producing Missing Pages of History and Africa on the Move. You've done a great contribution to the education and uplifting of the people, and your work will not be in vain. Certainly you will find rewards on this planet and on this earth. And we look forward to more and more accomplishments. You know, I bear witness to this one God, Jesus, who is the author and finisher of my faith, and that for government, mouth, say, tongue is his messenger. And, you know, today we don't reverse correct verdicts. I'm pro-choice and I vote. I believe women hold up half the sky. Therefore, I'm for the Equal Rights Amendment, ERA, yes. And the situation is that we have to unite the many to defeat the few. And Kamala Harris represents a process. She represents the democratic-minded people of this of the USA who want democracy in words and in deeds. And we have a new democratic revolution that we are struggling for, and we need to unite the many to defeat the few. You know, I'm pro-choice and I vote. I'm into politics. I'm not just a cultural worker. I'm into politics, and I leave it right there. Thank you.
I hear you, Brother Moses. I know you heard you say you're not into politics. You're in politics. At some point, you can tell the difference, share with that people the difference. But anyway, we're going to celebrate my birthday today, 65th anniversary, and we're going to celebrate it. And we're going to get on down so our people can get on up, share some important information, and get some important ideas and thoughts from your analysis as we discuss issues that are germane to our people's survival. What I want to do just in general, Brother Hackey, Brother Moses, Brother Hackey, you can leave us just briefly. One of the things, we are very loyal to our audience and to our followers. You know, we've been on for many, many years, and one of the things we try to do on every Sunday evening is to have a platform where we can speak truth to the powerful and the powerless. For the past 3-4 weeks, our family, our Blog Talk family, seems to be having some problems where it has impacted on our ability to come on the airwaves, and we can't figure out a way how to resolve the issues because we don't know what it is, and we still try to work with them to resolve it. So for our supporting audience and supporters, if you don't see us on Sunday evening at 7 o'clock, it's not because of us, because if there are certain means to this technology where we don't control, we don't use it. And like always, we is trying to figure out what it is about this particular program. There's now all of a sudden getting some kind of blockage. They seem to have a blockade against us. Brother Hackey, what do you think could be going on? I was given a report by one of the phone companies we deal with that they were not involved in this problem. So I'm just wondering what's going on. What is your take on this, Brother Hackey? Is that we doing something wrong or what?
Yeah, well, Brother Africa, you know, just to be very, very candid, I think what we have to appreciate is simply signs of the time. One of the things we have to fundamentally understand that as capitalism is in decline, one of the things that when you talk about, you know, progressive voices or revolutionary voices, it constitutes an implicit threat to the powers that be. In that regard, they don't want certain messages, certain ideas to get out there. I'm mindful of the fact that when you talk about the case of the Uhuru 3, in which they're charged with being, you know, unlawful agents of a foreign government, clearly it's an attempt to stymie the creation and growth of the Uhuru 3 movement. In fact, his brothers and sisters have been very instrumental in terms of doing some good work around the country. And so certainly, in the context of doing that work, they offer a critique of U.S. society, which is not particularly flattering, but truthful in terms of, you know, how capitalism works and the decline of capitalism. So one of the things, when you talk about Africa and the Move, and we talk about, you know, critiquing society, we don't pull in the punches. We actually talk about those things that are happening in the context of the system, which are certainly problematic for the African community. And we do so not just in terms of rhetorical, you know, statements. We do so in terms of using history itself, using examples, definitive examples, in terms of why we say what we say and the defending position that we take. So one of the things when we do that, we make clear in terms of the real contradictions that exist in the society, in terms of the aspirations of the African people in the society, and why our attempts in terms of being, you know, for lack of a better term, legitimate Americans, it becomes problematic. So clearly this kind of analysis in terms of exposing the system is something that they want to hear. One of the things we talk about the media and its power in terms of crafting a message or crafting a narrative, it's important for those positions of power to craft a narrative which essentially says that everything is fine, there's no problem, and the fact that if you just vote, that everything's going to be okay. Well, when you present a narrative which says that, well, that's bullshit, it doesn't work that way, that this is a system in place. This is not a question in terms of idealism. This is a question in terms of hardcore politics. And we talk about in terms of the foundation of capitalism. When you talk about a system essentially where the rich get richer and the poor get poorer, or you talk about a situation where wealth is fundamentally transferred from the poorest people in society to the wealthiest people in society, any critique that offers some clarity in terms of precisely what's going on gives us some clue in terms of why, when we talk about injustices that inflict African people, why when we talk about these injustices, why it's so relevant in terms of, you know, our struggles in the society. So clearly, Brother Africa, I think in terms of the kind of critique that we bring, and because we do it from a historical perspective and we bring up examples, concrete examples in terms of what we're talking about, I think those people in positions of power realize that in terms of their ability, in terms of manipulating the masses of people, it becomes complicated. And so therefore, the easy way to resolve that problem, as they see it, is to simply eliminate those forces that are progressive and revolutionary. One of the things I recall Malcolm X always said, that any time you're doing real good work, they're going to do what they can in terms of stopping you. There's no question in terms of Africa on the move significance in terms of not just in this country, but throughout the world. And so therefore, those people in positions of power realize that they got to try to somehow put an end to the growth of Africa on the move. And so by one of the ways in which they do this is simply limit our voices or terminate our voices by simply blocking the program so we can get the message out on the airwaves. So unfortunately, Brother Africa, as you alluded to, those kind of situations we don't have many control over. And certainly one of the things when you talk about organizations in terms of, you know, trying to combat, government strategy in terms of blocking voices, one of the problems is that these companies are not free to articulate, you know, their displeasure in terms of government, you know, strategies in terms of blocking certain voices. Because as part of the government strategy, certain in terms of government policy, one of the things is that when government does things like that, it's legit, and therefore anyone who actually, any organization that therefore exposes this kind of collusion, this kind of chicanery, stands to be in great, great trouble in terms of the laws as established, you know, both by the United States and the UK. So clearly, Brother Africa, what we have to say is very, very relevant to lots and lots of people, and those people in position of power understand their relevance, and so therefore their position is that we're simply going to limit their exposure by cutting off the program, so make sure people can't receive what they have to say. But the bottom line is this. Even though they're doing that, it doesn't matter. The bottom line is that the information, whether it exists on the community level or individual level, will persist. And the consciousness is out there, and so therefore, you know, no matter what they do, there are still ways in which we're going to struggle in terms of getting the word out there to people in terms of what's going on. So clearly, Brother Africa, this is part and parcel of where we are in terms of history. So when we look at this kind of oppression in terms of the message, then we understand that the country, the system is in deep, deep trouble, and therefore limiting voices is par for the course, and we shouldn't be surprised at all in terms of this kind of strategy, governmental strategy in terms of limiting our voices. And I conclude.
Thank you, Brother Hackey. Brother Moses, I'd just like to have your thoughts on, we'd like to have the community to listen to different voices. Yours is one of them. What do you think we can do to help our Blog Talk family network in terms of ensuring that our voice is not stifled, Brother Moses?
Certainly we need organization. Can you hear me?
Yes, hello? We can. We can hear you loud and clear.
Okay, certainly we need organization. We have to be organized. Nothing can be accomplished without organization. That goes without saying. And so communication is part of organization. Without communication, you know, there's a breakdown in organization. So the fact that the powers that be are trying to disrupt our communication is is in order for us to not be get organized, in order to prevent us from being organized and coming to the same conclusions about the problem. You know, he who feels it knows it. So a lot of people feel the problem, but feeling the problem and expressing the problem is a lot different from solving the problem, because you have to analyze and theoretically and consciously get to the root of the problem and offer a solution that is concrete and materialistic and that will make a difference. The superstructure is books, ideas, television, all sorts of cultural activities are part of the superstructure. But the real determinant of the superstructure is the economic base, and that is material. And politics determines that. Politics, the government, who's in control determines that. And so we have to be about getting in positions of power, and not just criticizing from the peanut gallery. I think, you know, like we have to get organized. We have to be organized, and the fact that people belittle the vote shows that there's a lack of organization and a lack of understanding of how change is going to take place. And so I'll leave it right there. Thank you.
Thank you, Reverend Moses. And to our listening audience, again, this is a special program. We are honoring and celebrating Brother Lee Robinson, better known as Brother Africa, on his 65th birthday and his 42 years of representing the African community. And been in the Pan-Africanist human rights socialist struggles. So we can talk a little bit more about his works, but more important right now, our birthday celebration will continue as we provide you with some information so that you can use it as a tool for liberation. We want you to sit back and just for the next 20 minutes or so, we're going to bring you Dr. Peter Clinton, who talk about the medical field, the medical association, the doctors, and the role that they play in the society. There's not necessarily a positive one. We want you to take this information in, and when you receive this information, we hope that you can use it as a tool to help move forward as a people and help make humanity better. We'll come back with a critique from our political panelists and analysts as we listen to Dr. Clinton as he talk about the medical field in this country.
Doctor, you hit on the third leading cause of death in the United States, and I'm sure most of us could figure it's either heart-related or cancer or diabetes, things like that. Can you clue us into what that is and why?
Okay, and thank you for asking that, because this is the 10,000-pound gorilla in the room that nobody's talking about. The third leading cause of death, as published in the Journal of the American Medical Association, is MD-directed treatment. This means you go to a medical doctor, an MD, he gives you a treatment and you die from it. According to the United States Department of Health and Human Services, 15,000 Medicare patients a month are killed by MD treatment, and nobody goes to jail. A handful of terrorists fly two planes into the Twin Towers. 3,500 people die and we go to war. But 15,000 people a month are killed by medical doctor treatments, and we don't bat an eyelash. This is because we have been, I don't want to say brainwashed, that's not the correct term, but we have been, for the last 100 years, kind of led into this false belief. You know, I think it was Marcus Welby that started it, that the medical doctor is king and knows everything about everything. And really, you need to just shut up and follow your medical doctor's advice. Most people in the United States have no idea at all of the history of the evolution of medicine in the United States. In the early 1900s, it was a relatively level playing field between the chiropractors, the osteopaths, the homeopaths, and the MDs. In 1915, 1920, there was something called the Flexner Report. The Carnegie Corporation funded this man named Abraham Flexner. He went all around the country, and he went on stagecoach and train and horseback. This was before the interstate highway system, right? took Flexner 5 years to do this. He went all around the country and did an inventory of all of the medical schools' prescribed drugs. He brought the list back to the Carnegies, who owned drug companies, and then the Carnegies and the Rockefellers gave millions of dollars of free money to the medical schools and hospitals in the United States that were prescribing drugs. That was the beginning of the end. After the Flexner Report, there was no more level playing field in the United States. And the MDs started a juggernaut that's taken off. Most people in the United States think that the predominant medicine here, MD-directed pharmaceutical medicine, we think that those guys are top dog because their therapeutics are better than the homeopaths or the naturopaths or the chiropractors. It's not. They're in the driver's seat because of political and financial coalitions that were built at the turn of the century that most people have no idea of at all. And it's a gigantic problem. And I mean, it's crazy, right? It's the third leading cause of death. And yet, when the government makes noise about messing with people's insurance, everybody freaks out.
Mm-hmm.
And that's a whole other thing to talk about, isn't it? Because what is medical insurance? When you buy medical insurance, what are you doing? You're betting that you're going to get so sick, you will not be able to afford it.
Mm-hmm.
Right?
Yeah.
Right. And then, so you pay good money every month to gain access to a system of medicine that's the third leading cause of death in the United States. We need our heads examined, quite frankly. That's why we give Dr. Wallach and myself collectively, we give 400 free lectures a year. And we're building a grassroots network because people don't know this. I mean, people come to my lectures and they look at me and say, couch potatoes live longer? Medical doctors are the third leading cause of death? You know, what's going on here? We're like the people, in Galileo's time saying, hey, everybody, you know, it's the sun that's at the center of the solar system, not the earth. Well, hey, everybody, the earth is round. It's not flat. Or, hey, everybody, slavery is a bad thing. Right? This is we have a social agenda here. Why do we have a social agenda? Because people are suffering needlessly. You wouldn't believe, as God is my witness, you would not believe the things that I've seen people recover from in holistic medicine. It's, the body's ability to fix itself is remarkable. Most of the time, all that the body needs to do that is the raw materials that it needs to do that. And we need to stop eating food that's hurting the body. You know, if you put diesel fuel in an unleaded engine, even if it's a brand new Ferrari, it's going to run like crap if it runs at all. There's nothing wrong with the car. It just had the wrong fuel.
Mm.
The same with the human body. You give the human body the raw materials that it needs, clean up the diet, Superman, Superwoman. And, you know, if you don't get the super status, then at least your blood pressure normalizes, at least your arthritis goes away, at least your anxiety and panic attacks go away, and you can sleep through the night.
Dad, you heard it. You heard a perspective on the medical situation inside of the U.S. and most likely throughout the capitalist world. It's a situation where they said 15,000 people have died because of the prognostics from these medical doctors. Now, if this is true, which I believe it is, and no one is saying nothing about it, once you hear the truth, what can be done to raise this issue and to make this an issue that we need to be aware of if this kind of killing, legal killing, is going on? I think one of the things that came from this particular documentary or video clipping is that clearly we must begin to condition ourselves and train our children not to accept everything that someone who claimed to be an authority or something, to accept it as being the gospel. Brother Hakeem, you heard what the doctor just stated about the number of deaths that is taking place due to neglect, misdiagnosed, improper use of chemical medicines, and it's killing our people. Your response to this phenomenon?
Well, you know, Brother Africa, I don't think anybody should be surprised. One of the things he didn't want to lose to, he didn't want to say that people are brainwashing to believing that doctors are guards. The reality is that the legitimate reality is that we do believe that somehow doctors are endowed with some special abilities, and that somehow they're infallible, and that's very clear. When we look in terms of the resistance of a lot of people, they've been questioning their doctors in terms of issues relating to their own health care, their own health. So it's very, very interesting. But one of the things when we talk about, we can dismiss this problem in terms of 15,000 people dying, you know, from medical device per year without understanding something about in terms of the power of the medical industry. Now, one of the things I think, just in terms of expenditures, you know, the medical industry spends about 15% of the U.S. GDP, and that's an awful lot of money, and that's a lot of power. In fact, in the year 2023, the pharmaceuticals, along with the medical industry, spent over $4.2 billion just on lobbying. And, of course, if we understand anything about lobbying, then we understand this is all about sending people to Washington, D.C. to lobby on their behalf. And now, what they're lobbying is not in the best interest of the people. They're lobbying for, you know, more profitability, you know, for the medical industry, and that's to some extent, Brother Africa, that's understandable. I think one of the things when you talk about the unimportance, you know, of the people that are dying, of these 15,000 who are dying per month, a lot of these people are 65 years and over, and so when we talk about Medicare specifically, when we talk about over 65 million people, including those people with disabilities, receiving Medicare, then the bottom line is that in terms of the system of delivering medicine for this particular group, it's not a high priority. And one of the things, the question becomes, well, do you have the same kind of problem that's unique in terms of wealthy people? Do wealthy people die excessive levels when it comes to medical advice as opposed to poor people? The answer is no. Poor people tend to die more disproportionately from medical advice. And there's a correlation between, you know, people being 65 years and older and their socioeconomic status or their lack of wealth in terms of, you know, this relationship between, you know, why 15,000 people die per month. So clearly when the question becomes, what can we do in terms of enlightening people in terms of this issue? Well, it's a very intractable problem, because one of the things that a lot of people do believe that doctors are somehow, you know, incapable of error, and as such, are not likely to even take this kind of report very, very seriously. But clearly, when you think about politicians in terms of their desire, in terms of cutting, you know, Medicare, one of the things, if you can demonstrate, you know, that Medicare is wasteful in the sense that when you talk about 15,000 people dying a month, that you say that Medicare is not actually delivering quality medication, then the question becomes, then why do you need to invest large sums of money in terms of Medicare? Simply because the outcomes are not that productive. And so we got to be very, very careful. It's a very, very slippery slope in terms of this argument around Medicare, because when we talk about these 15,000 dying a month, it feeds into the power of the right wing who want to cut Medicare in the first place, and they can use these numbers as justification to cut costs when it comes to Medicare. And we got to be very concerned about that. But more importantly, Brother Africa, when we talk about in terms of these 15,000 people dying, you know, a month, I think one of the things we got to talk about is medical outcomes. When you compare the United States, a medical outcome versus other G7 countries or Western industrialized states, America has the lowest outcome in terms of medical care. And there's no accident that's happening. In fact, there are numerous reasons in terms of why America health care, when it comes to medical care, is so poor. One of the things is the number of physicians in the United States. In fact, the American Medical Association has been a very good job in terms of reducing the number of physicians in the field in terms of ensuring profits remain high. In fact, if one of the things you've noticed here recently, when you go to your doctor, often you don't get a real MD. You get a physician assistant who's basically guided by a computer to tell them what to do, what questions to ask, and what treatments to give to people in terms of their medical conditions. So clearly, so when we talk about that 15,000 dying a month, they're not high priority. What is high priority is it's making profit. Secondly, I think that, you know, when we talk about in terms of the poor health outcomes in the United States, medical outcomes, we talk about the lack of universal health care. That is key because without universal health care, given the high cost of medical attention, of medical care, one of the things that is prohibitive. So when you got to pay lots of money and you don't have any money to get go, you're limited in terms of what kind of health care you actually get. So many people use the emergency room as a means in terms of seeking medical care. But what we understand, the medical emergency room's only obligation is to stabilize you. It's not to really treat you. It's to stabilize you. So if you come in with a bad heart and they give you something, you know, to make you feel a little better, you're stabilized, and they just kick out the door, and that the problem persists. And that's directly related to universal health care. Unlike other G7 nations, the United States doesn't have universal health care. So then you can certainly understand why 15,000 people per month would actually die from lack of medical care or medical information. Also, I think the socioeconomic inequality in the United States is devastating. When you talk about socioeconomic inequality, we can't dismiss the question in terms of lack of quality safety net or the level of stress or wages or even diet that people are subjected to. All those things contribute to your health. If, in fact, if you're lacking in terms of, you know, in terms of wages or in diet, or if you're combined with tremendous amount of stress, then the bottom line is that it's going to wear your body down more, which means you're more susceptible to all kinds of diseases. Well, the bottom line is that if you don't have any money and you're on Medicare, then the problem is that the kind of health, the kind of medical information you need in terms of being, you know, help, it's not forthcoming. But simply because you don't have those kind of monies, and the doctors understand when you talk about Medicare, those payments are capped, and so therefore you're only going to sort of get a certain amount. Doctors only receive a certain amount of money per action that they take in terms of patient. In that regard, doctors take shortcuts because there's really no profitability in terms of providing expensive tests when Medicare won't pay for it, which means that you don't receive the best quality information because it's not in the doctor's interest to give you quality information because they won't be compensated or paid for it. There's no profit in treating poor people. And so clearly, Brother Africa, I think so when we talk about this problem, I say it's intractable. The bottom line is that, you know, one of the things that the media is not going to talk about this in depth in terms of this particular problem. And to get the masses of people to understand fundamentally that this is an issue, it's a very difficult one. And let me just say one thing real quickly, Brother Africa, and I conclude. I think one of the things we have to be more scientific in terms of our analysis of things. We somehow, some of us, we treat the political system as though it's somehow a unilateral system. The U.S. government is a very complex bureaucracy. It's not one system. So if we think for one second that one individual can impact a system, a vast system, then we're sadly mistaken. The bottom line is that when we talk about the President of the United States, the President of the United States is limited in terms of what they can or can't do simply because they work through the context of a system or a bureaucracy. And each bureaucracy has its own mandates, its own focus. For instance, the medical establishment is totally different from the intelligence community, which is totally different from the military establishment, which is totally different from health. So we talk about all of these various bureaucracies that exist, and we expect that a president can resolve all these issues because we're talking about a vast system in place. So we got to be very, very scientific and stop this foolishness like somehow thinking that somehow that one person can actually solve all these problems. The bottom line is that we're talking about a system. And because we're talking about a system, so we talk about the 15,000 people dying per month, you know, who are on Medicare, and we're talking about people 65 years and older and people with disabilities. When we talk about a particular segment of society, then we got to be very, very clear. These people don't have any representatives because they don't have any wealth. If you have no if you don't have any wealth in society, then you're not represented. It's very, very simple. It's capitalist society. The reason why millionaires and billionaires get everything done that they want done, the reason why they have the best health care, the reason why they have the best schools, is because they can manage to manipulate the system in terms of using their wealth to get done what they want done. Poor people don't have that option. And it's foolish for us to think that somebody come in president and they can start saying, okay, well, here's the system with all these different bureaucracies, but I'm going to mandate each bureaucracy in terms of what it should do or shouldn't do. The reality is that the Constitution, the U.S. Constitution, defines in part how these bureaucracies should work. And so, and also when we talk about administrative laws, we got to understand that when we talk about each department, each part of the bureaucracy having all administrative mandates, then we can understand that no president, I don't give a damn who it is, whether they're black, white, blue, green, or yellow, cannot impact our entire system. So let's go up and create a foolishness about somehow that the president can some resolve our problems. It simply doesn't work that way, and I conclude.
Thank you, Brother Haki. As you said, there are people, in order to get on down, we have to get on up to struggle. So let's struggle tonight. Let's celebrate. And let's celebrate, as I say, as we go through our normal program or kicking the ballistics, or getting our people information so they can think and speak truth to the powerful and the powerless. And that's what my brother Moses is going to do right now. He's going to share with us his take on this problem of 15,000 people dying a month due to the neglect of the medical system, to the medical doctors. Brother Moses, based on what you heard, what is your take on that, Brother Moses? The mic is yours.
Yeah, we have a problem. We have a problem. 15,000 people is a lot of people. And, you know, we have a profit-driven economy. The political economy is profit-driven. So there's an incentive to be less responsive to poor people who cannot afford to pay for this medical system and the medical medicine and the various treatments that the system offers. You know, the doctors should be studied and intelligent, but you know, we find that you know, people manage to become doctors and don't necessarily have the expertise and the knowledge that is necessary to really truly help people. And so they're making a living off people, you know, people who are falling through the cracks and you know, this unregulated monitoring what's going on. The fact that this study showed that 15,000 people were dying, that's a form of regulation, a form of consciousness, a form of trying to hold these doctors and the system accountable for its results, the fruits of the system. And so, you know, we need a moral and ethical situation of people taking on morality and ethics seriously if they're going to be doctors and lawyers and whatever profession they're in. We people who are not just driven by money, but people who are actually concerned with the well-being of other people, and that they have a more of a priority along those lines. And you know, that's easier said than done. It's so easy to just go along and get along with the powers that be and the system as it is, the status quo, and nothing changes. You know, it's important that we have organized body, a professional organization. You know, the AMA is not getting the job done. We need doctors that are going to be held accountable, that'll make an issue of that 15,000. That should be an AMA issue. I mean, if the American Medical Association was conscious, they would be monitoring and consciously criticizing their institution and the doctors that make up the institution, and they will be responsible to the people and reflect the interests of the people. But right now, all we see is people getting richer and richer, and the poor getting poorer and poorer, and it's the political economy has to change, and that's a political economy. Politics is determining economics, and so we have to have people in state power, in government power, who are going to look out for the interests of the people. There's no way around that. There's no other way. We have to have people in state power and government who are going to look out for the interests of the people. And how do we accomplish that is the issue. And people have all kinds of theories about what can be done and what can't be done. But, you know, the bottom line is we have to get people in state power. Think Malcolm X thought a vote is so important that he said the ballot or the bullet. I think the Palestinian people can relate to that, the ballot or the bullet, because it's obvious how important it is in that situation. In the U.S. of A., we take it for granted because we have the facade of freedom and democracy and choice, and we choose to be ignorant. And I'll leave it right there. Thank you.
Thank you, Brother Moses, for your perspective. Like we say, Africa on the Moon, we come to listen and take in various different perspectives. Each individual speaking their perspective. It does not necessarily reflect the perspectives of this particular program, Africa on the Moon, and its hosts or its affiliates. So we'd like to hear your perspective. That called in at 323-679-0841. We can bring in that Sister Eleanor. Sister Eleanor, one of the things I think is happening is when you talk about the collusion of death as relates to an official policy of killing off the poor and weak is through medical practices, as the doctor stated earlier. If there's an epidemic of 15,000 people a month is getting unnecessarily dying, would equate to about 180,000 people a year. I mean, and for that to go unnoticed, it seems to me this is another tactic of how capitalism uses one's ignorance, how to use different institutions, such as in this case, the medical institution, to serve its interests for a few and not for the majority of us. So what is your take, Sister Eleanor, on this irresponsibility of the medical system as we see it practiced today in the U.S. and throughout capitalist countries? Sister Eleanor, the mic is yours.
Well, what's happened in the United States is that the pharmaceuticals have long ago taken over the medical school curriculum. And doctors today only have one course in nutrition, and they have very little courses in preventive medicine. So, and also insurance companies and large corporations have taken over hospitals, all sorts of industries, whether it's the cost of an MRI or something, it ends up being regulated by these mega medical capitalists, you know, in like MedStar in this region, for example. And this limits an individual's access to choice. The District of Columbia, for example, has only 4 hospitals, and it has 750,000 people, and it's the capital of the United States of America. Now, the way these people die, and what was your question again, Brother Africa? And happy birthday to you as well.
Thank you, Susan. I was just saying, Susan Eleanor, if you look at the role that the medical institution is playing in terms of killing off or being complicit of killing over 180,000 people a year when these lives could be saved, it seems to me this is just another tool of how the system used to fight against the interests of those who are poor, those who don't have wealth, those who don't suit their interests. And I'll just ask you to give your general response to that.
Well, that's very true. If you're dependent on Medicaid, the minute you turn 65, it affects the level of care, the level of rehabilitation that you will receive. you can go, you suddenly go from being an acute rehab patient to a subacute, meaning you get an hour a day of rehab, an hour and a half day of rehab. Well, some people, an hour and a half won't do it. And if they're not able to help themselves and they're only getting an hour a day of directed rehab, that impacts their health and their longevity. The reality is the U.S. has the among the worst medical systems in the quote developed world, and people who have money try to go other places for care, and those who depend on U.S. care or choose to receive U.S. care based on their class, they receive superior care. It's no doubt. It's not surprising that this study came out alleging that 15,000 people die a month because the conditions in the hospital are are deplorable, as well as the clinics. The doctors don't work for themselves anymore. They work for the hospitals, for the insurance agencies, for whomever. And this gives them very little options. You know, up until a few years ago, Brother Africa, the drug companies themselves were coming in paying doctors. The only way they could earn extra money was to prescribe certain medications, and they would get bonuses for prescribing those medications. Ergo, the oxycodone epidemic in this country. Also, surgeries. The only way some doctors can make extra money is through surgery. You see that MedStar just built a complete new surgical center in the District of Columbia, ambulatory surgery, so that might be hands, cosmetic surgery. I don't know exactly what, but I know the patients have a quick turnaround. And meanwhile, African Americans, in particular, African Americans, poorly in hospitals frequently. I had an opportunity to observe hospitals closely between 2022 and 2024, and I saw African Americans being treated disparagingly. A man came in for a hip replacement, but he could walk around and was having no pain, but his doctor told him he needed a hip replacement. Well, the first day he arrived at this hospital, the day before his surgery, he wanted to walk around the hall. Numerous patients were walking around the hall, but none on the ward, but none of them were African American. And he was told to stay in his room, and a policeman came up and sat outside his door to keep him from moving. Well, the next day after his surgery, we didn't hear from him again. And in theory, he's supposed to get up within 24 hours. I don't know whether they moved him, but I certainly never saw him. But I did see the police outside that door for at least two more days. I saw a family take their son out of a hospital in a wheelchair because they verbally were objecting to the standard of care. But the problem with this is that the average individual cannot afford to sue a doctor for malpractice, because in order to sue a doctor for malpractice, you have to have a medical expert that will testify against the action of the doctor. Well, though, that means other doctors, and they are out of range for the average working class person to be able to afford. Whether there's an obvious mistake or obvious neglect doesn't matter. What what is the reality is that the medical system is broke and it needs to be reevaluated and changed. And the fact that the pharmaceuticals impact medical school curriculum so much is an example, because their goal is to make money. You know, the Pfizers, these people, their goal is money, money, money. Not a thing about your health and recovery. So the reality is that we are an underserved community as African people, and senior citizens are underserved. And it is as stated in the article. Thank you for allowing me to take a few moments to speak, because the ADA is not doing its job, as Brother Moses said, and as he said about Malcolm X, the bullet or the ballot, and we definitely got a long ways to go, but we better pick up that ballot as a weapon right now. Thank you, Brother Africa, and happy birthday to you.
Thank you, Brother Sister. You listen to Africa on the Move.
And we need to reassess. Yeah.
Thank you, Brother Sister. You listen to a special segment of Africa on the Move. We are celebrating and honoring Brother Lee, better known as Brother Africa, as he celebrates today his 65th birthday. If you have any contributions you'd like to share with our listening audience on his life and his ongoing work, feel free to do so by calling in at 323-679-0841. The best way we can party, we say, is to give our people the proper information so they can use it as a tool for liberation. And we will continue the discussion talking about the medical system and how it's contributing to unnecessary deaths at a rate at the minimum of 15,000 a month. So right now we're going to our caller, who's 1111, who you blocked your number, we're going to bring you in, but we're going to ask you to be respectful. And what do you have to say, caller 1111? Welcome to Africa on the Move. Yes, caller, the mic is yours, 1111.
Yes. Hi, how are you? And are you guys in Africa or are you in the United States?
We're in Africa and all over the world. We're Pan-Africanists. Well, Africa is
our home.
Oh,
you're in Africa. Oh, yeah. Which South Africa?
No, we're Africa all over, I told you. Africa is our home.
Oh, okay. What country are you in? I am from Singapore, but I'm from USA also. But the question, absolutely, this story that you said, is that, again, it's in Africa or is it in United States? I think it's every... Go ahead, please, go ahead.
No, go ahead, Carl. Finish your point. Go ahead.
No. I think it's the same story happens because insurance companies in United States also, and the doctors, you know, they take the patient, they are supposed to have a surgery, but they change their minds, schedule the surgeries in United States due to discrimination on disability. There is a discrimination basis on nationality of origin, and many other discriminations that you are aware and I am aware of it too. It does happen in United States too, but not in Singapore. This is Brother Mike from Singapore. But the question is, you know, it's very sad that this thing is happening in your country and in United States as well. People need the surgery, so they have not to go look for different surgeon, and it takes time, effort, again, more money they have to spend to get to different doctors. So I empathy with you guys, my friends. And Ubuntu, and I'm sure you know Ubuntu, means I'm from who we are. And I hope you know that word. And I study Ubuntu. Very good. Thank you. Go ahead, sir.
Thank you very much, Brother Mike. Only response that I can have at this point in time to you is I would appreciate it if you don't impose your will on a people who are not an American. American, we are not from America. We are not Americans, and we are Africans. We are all one of Africans at home. So if you just keep that in mind, we greatly would appreciate that, okay?
Right. But it happens in the United States. So the famous story that you told, it really shook my heart because it does happen in the United States as well, to Canada as well, too. And this is not supposed to happen. You know, when you need a surgery, when you need a hospital, it should be available to you. They should not treat you based on the color, creed, religion, or disability or no disability, etc. I'm with you guys 100%.
Yes, we agree with you. Of course it happened in the United States. It happened in most so-called, quote-unquote, developed capitalist countries. That's a manifestation of capitalism. This is why people must come to understand their realities and where they fit in the scheme of things under the capitalist system. You know, it has no respect and no interest to ensure that the lifestyle of the masses will live in decency and they will not be exploited. So they must come to that realization to understand who is the enemy. Capitalism is the enemy to all mankind. So once the people come to understand that, I think they'd be in a better position to find ways to transform that society, transform the system, and fight for a more humane, just system, i.e. socialism heading towards communism. And this is something that people must come to understand. But anyway, Brother Mike, we're going to hold you, put you on hold, come back to you later on. We'd like to thank you. And to our listening audience.
And we need human capitalism. You know, the capitalism that exists today in the United States is not going to work. And that's why so much happiness in the United States. And we have political division in the United States right now. We have economic division. We have racial divisions in this country and et cetera, which is causing this country to be a next, Argentina, civil war, and, et cetera. But it's very bad for this country, but I hope people of America learn from Africa, learn from other countries that it had Beirut, Lebanon, and I hope the lessons from them can guide these people to be unity in diversity and peacefulness. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Brother Mike. And most definitely, I hope people in this country and the rest of the world will take a look at Cuba, can learn from Cuba and the Cuban Revolution in terms of how they view information and healthcare and how they view human beings not a means to an end. I mean, if a small country like Cuba can take care of its people with very minimal resources and being a blockade for over 60-some years, I mean, you know, this system in the United States is a joke. But anyway, we'll continue to try to go forward and back and forth. What we're going to do right now, we're going to take a revolutionary culture break. When we come back, we're going to talk a little bit about Brother Africa and 65th birthday. And if you want to share some flowers with him and share some wisdom and some encouragement to the brother, he can use it and get a chance to do that. And then we can close our program out with a very, very deep, intelligent discussion as it relates to what's going on in Palestine and Israel today. It's a subject that most people are scared to talk about, don't want to touch. But we know that on the truth is set us free, we must be truth is power. And we found this documentary a very interesting one as we critique and talk about this question of what it is to be a Jew, to be an Arab, and Zionism, and the role that it has played and continues to play to deceive the world as they continue to oppress and genocide the Palestinian people. So we're going to have that discussion when we come back, because this is our birthday today, our 65th birthday with Brother Africa. And he's going to speak not only to the powerful and powerless, but he's going to speak to the masses of the people. Because after all, they are the almighty ones who can make all things possible. We'll be right back. This is Africa on the Moon. To struggle, that's the only way you can make progress. you understand the necessity for organization. Brother Africa was very instrumental in terms of helping create such organizations and institutions such as this one, Africa on the Move, Blog Talk Radio, or Missing Pages of History, or as well as the African Awareness Association, which has been taking Africans and doing free drives to Cuba for over 25 years. We'd like to invite our listening audience and the public to take a trip to Cuba. Come and join us next summer 2025, as we take another free ride to Cuba. But more importantly, we understand the importance of culture, the importance of institution, and we want you to come. Help the AAPIPGC build the institution of African Liberation Day, which takes place every year in Malcolm X Park up in Washington, D.C., under their banner. And we want you to also help Africa on the Move under the banner of the African Women's Association as they plan for an international Pan-African Festival conference to be held in the city of the capital of the Confederacy. That's Richmond, Virginia, coming up in the fall of 2025. It will be an event that you've never seen before, but we're going to bring our people from all over together, and we're going to get this thing right. We're going to get on down so that people can get on up, but we need your support. If you can drop $81 million to Kamala Harris, then we know that you can send $1 or $2 to Brother Africa and the Africa on the Move and help us have this institution, which we're only trying to raise $5,200 to do this thing right. So please, make your donation now. Send it to African Awareness Association, P.O. Box 4433, Richmond, Virginia, 23220. Or you can send it by Cash App. That is $L, SE, c, O. Please, you know, where there are economic dependency, there can be no freedom. You know, we're in the seat, we're going to take the heat. As we define it, you know, we're not going to stand behind it. But we're going to do the right thing. We need your help. Brothers, sisters, people of goodwill, come and support us. We thank you. And on that note, what we would like to do for the next few minutes, as we continue to honor and celebrate the 65th birthday of Brother Africa, Brother Lee, we're going to turn it over to our participants and our panelists to have them say a few words about the life and work of Brother Lee and Brother Africa and what he has been trying to do and why we should support him. We start off with Brother Hackey. Brother Hackey, as we commemorate and celebrate the 65th birthday of Brother Africa, what would you like to say to your listening audience and why they should support this brother's work?
Yes, Brother Africa, I'll do that. But prior to doing that, let me just mention something, because one of the things I sit here and I listen to a lot of this commentary, and it gets surreal. And one of the things I don't want to happen is to go over the air. We say things that are just ridiculous. And I just don't want to stop going over the air and people think that we're all just somehow very, very ignorant. But here's the thing. When Malcolm X talked about the battle of the bullet, he was talking about the fact that we've been voting since the 19th century, and nothing materially has materialized in the interest of African people. Despite the fact that you got a lot of senators, state senators and Congress people in the United States, but if you look at the material condition of African people, it hasn't improved one iota. It speaks to a bureaucracy that's in place, a capitalist system, which is antithetical to the interests of African people. God damn, is that too hard to understand? Too hard, difficult to understand? Second thing, U.S. is not a democracy. It's not a democracy. It's a republic. The preamble to the Constitution tells you it's a republic. The way in which the political leaders get around that, they say it's a representative democracy. Even in the context of a representative democracy, it means that supposedly the people we elect represent our interests. We know damn well that none of these Congress people or senators represent the interests of poor folks. We know that. So it's not even a representative democracy. But more importantly, let's keep in mind, this is a republic, which means that the powerful rule. That's what a republic is. So damn, let's not have this discussion again. I hope this is clear, because some things just too stupid. Excuse me, some things just too ill enlightened, you know, to just to let fly. I sit here, I listen to this, and I'm like, damn, you're sending this across the world, and you create this image that we're all naive. We can't do that. We can't afford to do that. I can't be a part of something that's going to project ignorance. I just can't do it. I'm going to say this one thing very, very clearly, that this kind of stupidity has to come to an end. I don't care how you take it, but that's the bottom line. You say things that's just a lot moronic, and then it just makes no sense at all.
And then you say, you tell me you're a revolutionary and you say these moronic things, then you can't be a revolutionary if you say these moronic things. You're pulling my, you're playing games. I don't have time for that. If you're not serious about what you're doing, get the hell off Africa on the Move. You don't need to be a part of Africa on the Move if you're not serious about what you're doing. If it's for you to set the game, don't participate in it. Nobody got time for that. And I got to say that, get it off my chest, because then I'm fed up. I keep on listening to this craziness week after week and try not to say anything, but tonight it's just totally absurd. It's absurd. Malcolm X did not say that that voting is preferential to the bullet. He was making a call that, well, you got to make a decision, either the ballot or the bullet. If the ballot is not working for you, then you might contemplate the bullet. That's what he was talking about. Damn. This is not a democracy. It's a republic. How clear can we make that? Go read the U.S. United States Constitution preamble. It tells you it's a republic. Damn. Anyway, Brother Africa, listen, forgive me, Brother Africa, man. I'm just, you know, listen. The whole point is that, if you want to attempt to attack me, that's fine. I have no problem with attacks. If you attack me and you know what you're talking about, then we can have a principled discussion. But if you attack me and you're saying shit that's ignorant, you're saying it simply because you want to say it or simply because you want to be right, time for that. I don't have time for that. You know what I mean? This is a program about enlightening people. It's not about reinforcing ignorance. It's not about that. If you want to go reinforce ignorance, go to one of those right-wing black programs which they reinforce ignorance all the time. This is not the platform for you if you want to reinforce ignorance. And I'll close with that, Brother Africa. But anyway, in terms of why we should support you, Brother Africa, one of the things, let's be very, very clear. One of the things in terms of when you've engaged in this work for over 42 years, let me tell you something. The kind of stress that you have to endure in terms of being able to reach people is not a very, very easy thing to do. Despite that reality, you persist. So your ability to persevere, to contend with these issues, I mean, very stressful issues in terms of trying to reach people, and maintaining the course is something that should be applauded and respected. The bottom line is that many, many people get involved in politics after 5 or 10 years. They're out because they can't deal with the stress they have to endure in terms of trying to reach people who, for whatever reason, don't want to be reached or who are socially, politically conditioned to think certain things which were counterproductive in terms of a movement. But so when you try to engage such people, the only thing you get back is a lot of ignorance. And so people after 5 or 10 years say, you know what, I give up, and it's better to let the system teach them, because talking to them ain't going to get it. So let the system give them a hard time. Then maybe they'll come to realize the reality in terms of what's really going on. So when you take the opposite position, you say, listen, despite the confusion out here, you persist. You keep on after 42 years, you persist. Your tenacity, your perseverance in terms of trying to reach our people does indicate a deep love for our people, and you got to be respected for that, Brother Africa. I mean, really, really. Nobody does this for 42 years if they don't have an immense love for the masses of the people or immense love for humanity generally. So for that, Brother Africa, you know, I think people should, you know, people should certainly understand, you know, that your commitment in terms of the aspirations of African people is above board. It's beyond reproach. So in that regard, Brother Africa, you know what I'm saying? One of the things that, you know, when you know people like you, who have been doing this thing for a long, long time, who are consistent, then it speaks volumes in terms of who you are as an individual, as a principled individual. And I think one of the things I alluded to earlier, I think one of the things when we talk about in terms of just your intellect, in terms of you got a great business acumen. I mean, you could have used your business acumen, your business skills to make lots and lots of money, and people wouldn't even know what you were doing. You didn't do that. You use your business acumen, you use your skills, you use your intelligence to move our people forward. So for that, Brother Africa, I certainly hope people begin to understand, you know, your commitment to the masses of people, your commitment to humanity is deep. And one thing, I applaud you, brother, you know what I mean? So, you know, on that I can say, you know, many, many more years to you in terms of, you know, the struggle in terms of trying to reach out people. I know it's not easy. You know, I know you, it takes some after a while. You've been dealing with this stuff for a while. It gets to you after a while. But you've been very, very, very patient in terms of dealing with, you know, some outrageous commentary and not let it affect you. And it's not easy to do that. So for you, Brother Africa, you know, you're a great inspiration to lots of people in terms of out here, you know, who are trying to do the right thing. It's not easy, but we commend you for doing the right thing. And I conclude.
Thank you, Brother Haki. Going to Brother Moses. Brother Moses, you can share your thoughts, you can share your flowers, you can share whatever you want to share as we commemorate and celebrate 65 years of Brother Africa. Today is his birthday. Your thoughts, Brother Moses.
Happy birthday to you. Happy birthday to you. I think, you know, like, it's great that people are motivated and committed to the struggle of African people. I think that's outstanding. I don't question motivation and intent. However, you know, we take scientific socialism, Marxism, Leninism, Mao Zedong, Floyd, scientifically analyzing the world and changing the world. And emotionalism is you know, a result of an inability to effectively change things in argument. And so, you know, like, I recognize the frustration and stuff, but, you know, the road to hell is paved with good intentions. I mean, you know, we have to be scientists. We have to take up the concrete struggle and deal with reality. And Malcolm X said the ballot of the bullet, because that's how important the bullet and the ballot are. It equated. It's like, if we can't vote, then we're going to result to the bullet. That's what the Palestinian people are saying, and that's what we should be saying in the U.S. of A. That's how important the vote is to us, because that's the only way we can overthrow the system. But even then, we're going to have to vote at some point. And so no matter where around it, the vote is important. And I'll leave it right there. Thank you.
Thank you, Brother Moses. From Eleanor, would you like to share with Brother Africa as he continues to honor and celebrate his 65th birthday today?
And Brother Haki is correct. The United States is a republic. It is not a, quote, true democracy. It is not every vote counts. And that's why they're constantly trying to legislate everything back to the states. And it's important that we unite around all the tools we have. And Brother Africa, you are an intellect, you're a gentleman and a scholar, and this forum is a wonderful thing, and the amount of time and work you commit to the public is phenomenal. So I'd just like to say thank you for myself, and I'm sure for thousands of other people. And we know that in Cuba, you're loved. In Colombia, you're loved. In Venezuela, in Guyana, Jamaica, you are loved. And I'd like to thank your guest, Brother Mike. He brought up something very important about the United States, about it having a discriminatory medical system, and that there is inequity in medicine, and doctors that you don't even know and may not be responsible for your care can make tremendous decisions about your health and your life and your longevity. And it's a dangerous system. And as Brother Haki had mentioned, lobbyists, the medical industry and the insurance industry, whether it's pharmaceuticals or insurance, spend millions of dollars lobbying on the Hill to have legislation passed that supports their interests, not the interests of the people, but the interests of their business interests, their corporate interests. And as your guest, Brother Mike, said, capitalism is not the way to go. And he talked about, I believe, did he say Sri Lanka? Is he from Sri Lanka? And he talked about equity in medicine. And we see all around the world right now, people are talking about the vote. We see that William Ruto in Kenya right now is in a month of struggle where the young people are standing up. He was forced to change his parliament, and I believe he's going to reduce the 47 governors down as the youth are speaking. So, you know, society functions on, we don't have a socialist system right now, but we need to work and organize. And we, unfortunately, in this republic, we are in a serious struggle against authoritarianism, not just war capitalism, but authoritarianism. And it's up to us to stand united. And we more than ever have to do it in 2024 at the ballot box. People do not gain from suffering. If you think we suffered now, wait if we let 4 years of the Republican candidate go forward. And if we do not vote, we are in effect saying we want that candidate. We stand with the Republicans. So people need to decide where they stand. Voting is only a tool. And Brother Haki said, as he said, it's so true, this is not a democracy. A democracy is every vote counts. Well, every vote doesn't count in the United States, but it does count in every state because this is a republic. And every state has so many electoral colleges, and that's what puts the person in the White House. So we have to do more about educating, but we start by telling every person to vote. And so many Africans that are born in the United States say, look, the voting doesn't matter because it doesn't do anything for me. We are at the bottom of the barrel, but we have to organize and support each other and change that. It's up to us to stand united. And we unite by, as Brother Anthony often says, by organizing, and by Brother Ike also says, organizing. And what you do for the people, Brother Africa, is give them a voice and give them an opportunity to learn and to organize and to share their ideas. But most importantly, you are an educator. Through this forum, you allow us to learn and us to be able to share what we've learned with other people. And I just want to say thank you. And I'm sure we'll see you and we'll all be together in 2034 celebrating your 75th anniversary. So thank want to say, not everyone is a Christian, but I want to say to you, God be with you. Alhamdulillah. Glory to our Lord Jesus Christ for blessing us this day with the breath of life and having this opportunity to share this time with you. Thank you so much. And blessings be to all the analysts. And thank you. I can't say it enough.
Thank you, Sister Eleanor, and to our listening audience supporters. I am making an appeal to everyone who is in this program for your support. There's a lot of work that must be done and needs to be done. And we ask you, If you are in a position to make a contribution, please send your contribution to African Awareness Association, P.O. Box 4433, Richmond, Virginia 23220, or you can cash app us at African Awareness Association at Gmail, or you can do it at cash app, $L, small e, small c, small r, small o, small b. And one correction, if you zell it to African Awareness Association at 2, not cash app, African Awareness Association 2 at gmail.com. Your support is needed. There's a lot of work to do. And wherever there is economic dependency, there can be no freedom. So we must build and support our own institution. We need your support. We thank you. So as we continue to celebrate my 65th birthday, what we're going to do is take a station break. And when we come back, we will ask you, the listening audience, and our panelists to respond to this audio clipping that will talk about this whole issue of Arab Jews and the hidden history. Yes, we only can play about 20 minutes of it, but there are some significant points that will be raised in this clipping that we hope to bring some clarity to this whole issue of what's going on today as it relates to this so-called Palestinian-Israeli issue that's taking place. We'll be right back, and like we say, we're in the seat, we'll take the heat. If we can define it, we will stand behind it. We will take you to the water, but we can't make you drink it. So we'll be right back. Listen, and we'll be right back. This is Brother Africa, and this is a special edition of Africa on the Move on the 65th birthday, July 27th. We'll be right back.
Burn it all. One cider vinegar? Is it B, tea tree oil?
Jews in Israel today are less safe than anywhere else in the world. But it's much, much worse than that, because Israel generates anti-Semitism. Israel is responsible for the upsurge of hostility towards Jews everywhere.
The Israeli state and its supporters have a clear narrative. All Jews have a stake in Israel. All Jews are represented by Israel. And regardless of where they live or how they feel about Israel, Israel is the ultimate guarantee of Jewish safety. But this week's guest argues that this isn't and has never been true. Historian and author Avi Shlaim was born in Baghdad in 1945. His family had lived in Iraq for literally millennia, and they considered themselves just as Arab as their Muslim and Christian neighbors did. The foundation of the State of Israel changed all that, and in Shlaim's view, for the worse. We talk about how Israel has warped and reduced Jewish identity, the hypocrisy of left-wing Zionists, and Mossad's secret bombing campaign against Iraqi Jews. I learned a lot from this interview, and I hope you do too. Avi Shlaim, thank you so much for joining us.
It's a pleasure to be here with you, Ash.
So my first question is, before 1948, in broad terms, how would you describe the experience and culture of Arab Jews living in the Middle East?
Before the emergence of the State of Israel in 1948, there was a large number of Jews living in the Arab world, something like 800,000 Jews. And there were Jews in Lebanon, in Syria, in Egypt, in Iraq, where I come from. In Iraq, there were 135,000 Jews before the establishment of the State of Israel, and then nearly all of them ended up in Israel reluctantly. But there were Jewish communities throughout the Arab world. The Jewish community in Iraq was the most ancient, going back to 2.5 millennia ago. It was the most prosperous, the most successful, and the best integrated into local society. So this was something that completely changed the face of the Middle East. Today we have complete and stark division with Israel on one side and Arabs on the other side. But before 48, there were Jews throughout the Arab world, and Muslim-Jewish coexistence was not a distant dream. It was the everyday reality. And my book, Three Worlds, Memoirs of an Arab Jew, has aroused a lot of interest in the Arab world, because young Arabs, not so young, any Arabs born after 1948 would have no idea, they would have a clue that the face of the Middle East was totally different, that Jews and Arabs lived side by side until the arrival of Zionism and the establishment of the Jewish state, which was a real a point of real division and polarization in the area.
You talked about the coexistence between Muslims and Jews in the Arab world before 1948. To make it tangible, in terms of things like food, socializing, music, even mixed relationships, what was the kind of cultural glue holding people together?
The language was a glue, a very important factor. My family and I, we were Arab Jews. We spoke Arabic at home. We didn't speak any other language. Our culture was Arab culture. Our food was the most delicious, spicy Middle Eastern food. It wasn't European food. My parents' music was a very, very nice blend of Jewish and Arabic music. So in every sense of the word, we were Arab Jews. We were Iraqis whose religion happened to be Judaism, and there were Iraqis whose religion was Muslim, and there were Iraqis whose religion was Christian. But we were all Iraqis, and we were united by that. Furthermore, we Arab Jews had much more in common linguistically and culturally with non-Jews around us. We had much more in common with them than we had with Jews in Eastern Europe.
And when you say had more in common with the non-Jewish neighbors in the Arab world versus Eastern European Jews, what were the differences culturally between Arab Jews and Eastern European Jews?
In Europe, the Jews were the other, in inverted commas. The Jews stood out. Europe had a Jewish problem. Germany had a Jewish problem. Adolf Hitler thought he had a solution to the Jewish problem. Iraq did not have a Jewish problem. Iraq had a lot of minorities. It had Christians, Chaldeans, Assyrians, Turkmens, Circassians, Jews, a lot of minorities. And the Jews were one minority among many. And they were treated no better and no worse than the other minorities. And there was a long tradition of religious tolerance between the different minorities. In Iraq, the Jews did not live in ghettos. They lived everywhere with the rest of society. And anti-Semitism is a European malady. Anti-Semitism grew in Europe, and from Europe it was exported to the Middle East. And one proof of that claim is that there was no literature in Arabic, anti-Semitic literature in Arabic. So when there was when anti-Semitism took off in Iraq after the First World War, anti-Semitic literature had to be translated from European languages to Arabic, literature like Adolf Hitler's Mein Kampf. So that's the difference, that we felt at home, we were treated as locals in the Arab world, whereas in Europe, the Jews were always a separate class of people and a problematic class. And it took Europe much, much longer than the Arab world to start treating the Jews as co-citizens. And even before the Jews got full rights in the Arab world, at least they were citizens. They were second-class citizens, but it was much, much better than the status of the Jews in Europe. And it took Europe much, much longer to come to terms with the fact that Jews are ordinary human beings who deserve equal rights.
Can I play devil's advocate for a second? There are people who would listen to this and would maybe say, aren't you looking back with rose-tinted glasses? There's anti-Semitism in Islamic texts. There's anti-Semitism which is, you know, core to the Muslim identity. I don't think that. I'm Muslim. But many would say that, in particular, Israel's advocates. How would you respond to that accusation?
I would respond by saying that you can always find quotations to support your point of view. And you can always pick some lines in the Quran and say this is proof of anti-Semitism. But to counter that, there are so many quotations in the Quran that are not only not anti-Semitic, but the opposite. And in general, in Islam, the Jews are treated with respect. The Ahlul Kitab, they are the people of the book. And so are Christians, incidentally. They're also the people of the book, and they're treated with great respect. So you can always find selective quotations to argue whatever you like. Another variant of this argument for which you play devil's advocate is that Islam is incompatible with democracy. And you can find quotations to suggest that. But if you look seriously and objectively at Islamic scriptures, at the Quran, you'll have to conclude that there is nothing in Islam which is incompatible with democracy. And this is if you look at it objectively, and I define objectivity as uncritical acceptance of my views.
That's so funny. That's how I define objectivity too.
My wife defines objectivity as male subjectivity.
I think she's right. When did the status of Arab Jews begin to change? Was it with the emergence of Zionism in Europe? Was it the Arab Revolt? Or was it the 1948 establishment of the State of Israel?
It's a gradual process, and it's difficult to put your finger on one particular date. But in the aftermath of the First World War, Britain sponsored the Zionist movement. And so one key date is the Balfour Declaration of 1917, in which Britain pledged support for the establishment of a national home for the Jewish people in Palestine. This was a classic colonial document which completely disregarded the rights and aspirations of the local people. In 1917, the Arabs were 90% of the population, the Jews were 10%, and the Jews owned 2% of the land. And yet Britain, the colonial power, chose to privilege the Jews over the Arabs. And I've written a lot about the history of the British Mandate in Palestine from 1920 to 1948. But I can summarize it for your listeners in one sentence, which is that Britain stole Palestine from the Palestinians and gave it to the Zionists. That's why resentment of the Zionist movement started to build up, not just in Palestine, where the Arabs were being displaced by the Zionist project, but throughout the Arab world, there was real sympathy for the Palestinians. And there is still strong sympathy for the Palestinians throughout the Arab world today. And I'm not talking about governments, I'm talking about people. So that was one factor that changed. The Jews in Iraq were associated with Britain, the colonial power, and because Britain was responsible for the displacement of the Palestinians from Palestine by the Zionists, that fed into hostility towards the local Jews. Then the other turning point is 1948, the establishment of the State of Israel and the First Arab-Israeli War. This is when ethnic cleansing happened. This is when Israel expelled 750,000 Arabs. They became refugees. More than half the Palestinian population became refugees, and the name Palestine was wiped off the map. This is the Nakba. It had repercussions throughout the region. The Iraqi army fought in the war for Palestine. At the end of the war, Israel signed armistice agreements with all its neighbors. These are the only internationally recognized borders that Israel has ever had, and they are the only borders that I recognize as legitimate. This is the pre-1967 borders. The Iraq did not sign an armistice agreement with Israel. The Iraqi army withdrew from Palestine, and Iraq is still officially at war with Israel. It's in the aftermath of this war that there was an upsurge of hostility towards the local Jews in Iraq and elsewhere throughout the Arab world. And there was popular hostility towards the Zionists, but also there was hostility at the official level. The Iraqi government began persecuting the Jews in Iraq. The whole climate changed. Jews were expelled, were fired from government service. Restrictions were placed on the activities of Jewish merchants and Jewish financiers. Quotas were imposed on the number of Jews who could go to universities and medical schools. So this was a real turning point in Muslim-Jewish relations in Iraq.
In a way, you stop being Iraqi and you start becoming Israelis who are living in Iraq in the eyes of the government.
This is absolutely right, in a nutshell. And I have a remote relative. He was a writer, Yitzhak Bar Moshe. He moved to Israel. In Israel, he wrote 10 books, all in Arabic. And one of them is called Al-Khuruj Min Al-Iraq, the exodus or the departure from Iraq. And he says, we left Iraq as Jews, and we arrived in Israel as Iraqis. But it's Israel that made all the difference, because Zionism gave the Jews a territorial dimension for the first time in two millennia. Now, Zionism created a Jewish state in Palestine. Anyone in the Arab world who didn't like Jews, anyone like the Istiklal Party, the right-wing party in Iraq, which was very anti-Jewish, and any anti-Semite could say to the Jews, you don't belong here, you're not from here, you are alien, and why don't you go and join your brothers in Palestine? So the whole attitude towards local Jews changed. And the Jewish community in Iraq, which had contributed to nation building at every level, changed, or the perception of this community changed, and from being a constructive pillar of Iraqi society, it was viewed increasingly as a fifth column.
How was the Nakba understood? Jews living in the diaspora, particularly in the Arab world? How did they think about it?
1948 was a very, very anxious time for the Jews in the diaspora and in the Arab world, because whatever they felt about Zionism, they were now seen as implicated in what was going on in Palestine. And Zionism was a movement by European Jews for European Jews, which had very little appeal to Arab Jews. And the Zionist movement the Zionist leaders had no interest in the Jews of the Arab countries. They tended to look down on them as no better than Arabs, as primitive, as backward. What changed that was the Holocaust. The Holocaust removed the main reservoir for Jews, for the Jewish state to be. And it's only then that Zionist leaders began to look for Jews from all four corners of the earth, including the Arab world. So the attitude of the Zionist movement towards Arab Jews change, and now Arab Jews who had no interest in Israel were felt unwelcome, unsafe, and many of them ended up in Israel. My mother used to wax lyrical about the wonderful Muslim friends that we had in Baghdad. And one day I said to her, did we have any Zionist friends? And she looked at me as if this was a very peculiar question. And she said to me, no, Zionism is an Ashkenazi thing. It's nothing to do with us.
And so that ethnic stratification of Jews, so Sephardic Jews, Ashkenazi Jews, Mizrahi Jews, what kind of impact does that have in contemporary Israeli society? Because I don't think all of these terms will be that familiar to our audience.
Ashkenazi Jews are the Jews of Europe and North America, by and large. And Sephardi Jews are the Jews of the Middle East, North Africa, and the Middle East, and some countries in Eastern Europe, like Bulgaria as well. The name Sephardi comes from Sfarad, which is Spain. And the name Sephardim comes from the Jews who were expelled from Spain and Portugal in 1942. And from Spain and Portugal, sorry,
1492.
In
1492.
I was going to be
like Christopher Columbus in 1942. I didn't do
history GCSE. Well done. Thank you for the correction. The Jews were expelled in 1492 from the Iberian Peninsula, and they wandered, they settled down in North Africa and in the Middle East, and they're called Sephardim. Now, Israel was created in 1948, and all the Jews from Arab countries who ended up in Israel are called Mizrahim. Mizrah in Hebrew means east, so Eastern Jews, and that's a collective term from Jews wherever they came from in the Arab world, Morocco, Tunisia, Egypt, Lebanon, wherever. And this is a common term, Mizrahim, for all Jews of Arab origins.
Because Jabotinsky, who, as I understand it, was an early Zionist, he wrote, "We Jews have nothing in common with what is denoted the East, and we thank God for that." When the image of the Zionist Jew is completely antithetical to what it means to be Arab, even if you're an Arab Jew, what did that mean for Arab Jews in Israel?
So Jabotinsky was the spiritual father of the Israeli right, and in 1923 he wrote an article, "The Iron Wall: We and the Arabs," and this is the Bible of Zionist foreign policy. It was in two parts: an analysis of a problem and a solution. The problem was that the Zionists wanted to establish a Jewish state in Palestine. Jabotinsky said, "The Arabs are not a rabble. They are a people. No people in history has ever willingly made way for another people to come and build a state on their land. And therefore, Arab opposition to Zionism is inevitable and inescapable. So what do you do?" His answer was to build an iron wall of Jewish military strength. The Arabs would knock the head against the rampart. Eventually, they'll give up the hope of defeating the Jews, the Zionists, on the battlefield. And then will come the time for negotiations with the local Arabs about the rights and status in Palestine. So that was Jabotinsky's strategy for in two stages. First, build up military force, and then negotiations from strength with the Arabs. the trouble with Netanyahu and the people like him in the more extreme right-wing Zionist in Israel and the religious Zionist in Israel today is that they only understood the first part of the strategy, building enough military force in order to subdue the Arabs indefinitely, rather than negotiate from strength a political solution to what is a political problem. So there's one other point about Jabotinsky and all the other Zionist founding fathers, Theodor Herzl, Chaim Weizmann, and it was the orientation on the West. They all didn't saw the Jews as not being part of the Middle East, and they didn't want to integrate into the region. They saw Israel, they saw the Jewish state as an outpost of Western colonialism. And Jabotinsky is a classic example of that. He said, we have nothing in common with the Arabs, and thank God for that. But he also said, we will man the ramparts of the West against Eastern barbarism. And that tells you something about the Zionist movement and its geopolitics, that the emphasis was not on finding modus vivendi with the local Arabs. The emphasis was always on having the support of the great powers.
So first the British Empire, yes. Now the American,
yes.
Empire. Has there ever been a strain within Israeli politics who have wanted to turn away from the great powers of the West and remake Israel as something which is more integrated with its Arab neighbors? Or does that just not really exist as a distinct political trend?
It was a distinct Jewish school of political thought about the conflict. This was the big issue. This was the big question, that in the land of the aspirations of the Zionists, and other people already lived. So what do you do about them? Jabotinsky had one solution, build up military force and squeeze them out. But there was a moderate strand in Jewish political thought in Palestine, which advocated coexistence in a binational state. The president of the Hebrew University, Dr. Judah Magnus, was one leader. The philosopher Martin Buber was another leader of a movement which was called Ichud, Unity, which advocated a binational state. But this was overtaken by events in 1948 when Israel used military force very effectively to cut through the Gordian knot. And after that, we don't see, it's only a marginal group of Canaanites who are not Israeli nationalists who want to go back to the original land of Canaan and define their cultural identity as Canaanite. But this is not a significant political movement.
Is there a sort of double-facedness?
Are you still interested in a solar-powered generator? Because pay special attention, because I'm going to do something.
Which the Zionist project has positioned and thought of Arab Jews, because on the one hand, it's very Ashkenazi, as you said, but on the other hand, Arab Jews and the cultural identity of Arab Jews, whether that's food, whether that's names, it lends a kind of indigeneity to the Zionist project. So Arab Jews might be looked down upon, but also at the same time, they're seen as a very authentic expression of what it means to be an Israeli.
Indeed, and one positive recent trend is that Arab Jews, or the descendants of Arab Jews, are very proud of the Arab heritage and of their folklore and culture. And I say the descendants of Arab Jews because all Israelis born since 1948 are not strictly speaking Arab Jews. I'm an Arab Jew because I lived in Baghdad before Israel was established. But the Mizrahim, the descendants of the Arab Jews, are more than half the population in Israel. But most of the elite, the political, the military, certainly the cultural elite, they're overwhelmingly Ashkenazi. And there is still a tendency among the elite to look down on the Mizrahim in Israel. And I would have liked Israel to become part of its environment, to integrate into the region. And therefore, I had hopes that the Arab Jews would become a bridge between Israel and the Arab world. But the Ashkenazi elite never wanted a bridge to the Arab world, and therefore the Arab Jews never, the Mizrahim, never fulfilled that function in Israeli society.
Isn't there also a problem of trying to see the Mizrahim as a bridge between Israel, the Arab world, when Palestinians are denied their political rights, the right to self-determination, the right to land, the right of return, because you can't both be, I guess, proud of an Arab identity and integrated with your Arab neighbors if at the same time you believe in a project of Jewish supremacy on a territory that Palestinians also have the right to call home.
That is a very, very real problem for Arab Jews. And the great majority of Mizrahim resolve it by becoming Israelis, by overcompensating, by becoming more right-wing, more Arab-spurning than most Ashkenazim.
It's sort of like the more English than the English thing.
More English than the English. In America, the equivalent would be poor white people who become American nationalists and look down on the Arabs. So that is true of the Mizrahim in Israel. To establish their credentials as Israeli patriots, they adopt strong anti-Arab positions. But that's...
You have been listening to a documentary titled Arab Jews, The Hidden History. Ash Shikar meet Ivan Slain. He's telling his perspective on this whole issue of the struggle between the variations of Jews and the Zionists. It's really interesting, one of his statements, he made the point that Britain stole Palestine from the Palestinians and gave it to the Zionists. And the Zionists wanted to build up its military force and take it, and then stop from the position of strength to negotiate from something that you have taken. So just listen to some of these contradictions and issues that's going on. And matter of fact, one point he raised that it's the Zionist state of Israel that is creating the insecurity of, and they are the ones who have been anti-Zionists, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. He raised many contradictions and issues in trying to speak to the clarity of this whole question of the role of Zionism and its impact, not only in Palestine and against the Palestinian people, but also its role as it relates to the world. So we'd like to encourage all conscious people who are interested in finding out more about this particular battle and struggle. Please check out that particular documentary by going to YouTube. And we'd like to thank Novel Media for sharing this perspective with the rest of the listening world. So at this point in time, we can go back to our political panelists and analysts. Based upon what you have heard, Brother Haki, and I'd like for you to speak on this philosophy of taking something by might, to force the people to negotiate from a position of weakness. Is that just your response to the documentary, Brother Haki?
Yeah, well, I think, you know, I think Herschel's premise is very, very clear. I think his premise was, you know, Jews, Israel for the Jews. I don't think he was ambiguous about that at all. I think he's very clear on that point. So when you talk about in terms of his relationship between the Jewish leaders and the West, and when you talk about the Jewish leaders' preference, you know, for Western states or how they lionized or respected Western states and want to be like Western states, it speaks volumes in terms of just how they saw the Palestinians. So this question in terms of two-state solution living side by side was never really an issue for the Zionist leadership, and that's very, very clear. One of the things that was very interesting when he talked about, you know, the final solution in terms of Hitler, in terms of the promulgation of anti-Semitism coming out of Europe, is very, very interesting, you know, that when he talked about the fact that you had these two cultures living side by side prior to 1948, but after 1948, things deteriorated in part because of the psychological operations by the Zionists in conjunction with Western states like the United States and the UK. So, but specifically, when we talk about the psychological operations that they employed in terms of bringing the Zionist regime into power, one of the things that many people realize, but when you talk about Hamas currently, Hamas is a creation of the Zionists. They created specifically as a counterbalance to the Palestinian Authority. In other words, in order to make the Palestinian Authority look good, they created these boogeymen to sort of terrify the Jewish population, you know, into submission. In other words, they got the Jewish population out of fear to do whatever they tell them to do and to see the Muslims as the definitive enemy. Also, when we talk about the psychological operation in terms of the Zionists, I think one other thing is that, you know, it's very interesting when they talk about the fact that Islam is incompatible with democracy. That is very, very interesting because if you think about U.S. history in terms of incompatibility, it's the same damn thing they said about the indigenous population in America. They said they were incompatible, you know, with the mores and the values of society. It's very, very interesting. So there's a certain amount of not just arrogance, but a certain amount of contempt for people that you pinpointed to be victimized, and you turn around and actually victimize those folks and creating a justification to victimize them, you know, in terms of narrative created specifically for the sole purpose of victimizing people. So the Zionists and the United States histories are very, very interesting in that regard. Also, I think, you know, one of the things also, when he talked about 1967, you know, the Arab-Israeli War, when he talked about three quarters of the Arab population was displaced, it's very, very clear, Brother Africa, just from that maneuver alone, that this question in terms of a two-state solution was never an issue. So when he talked about negotiating from a position of strength, that wasn't an issue. The issue was about how do we best, how we best facilitate our desire in terms of a totally controlled Jewish state. So I think that was real motivation. So when we talk about three quarters of the Arabs being displaced, that wasn't because they had any intentions whatsoever in terms of sharing that landmass with the indigenous people. Their intent was to eliminate the Arab people totally. So we talk about the problem that exists in the Middle East. You know, we have to lay the problem squarely at the foot of the Zionists. And just to add, one of the things that you and I understand, Brother Africa, Israel wasn't the first place that they looked at in terms of colonizing, you know, for so-called Jewish state. It's very, very clear that, you know, these people in terms of, you know, trying to do that which is correct or that which is politically principled has never been a consideration. And finally, Brother Africa, I thought it was interesting, this whole colorism thing. So when we talk about the so-called Holocaust that happened in Europe, you would think that the fact that these Europeans did these quote-unquote horrible things to the Jewish people that you would then turn around and duplicate those kind of behaviors toward other people, but yet they did. So that speaks volumes in terms of this whole question in terms of colorism, because this whole notion in terms of the Ashkenazi versus the Sephardic Jews, in terms of Sephardic Jews being a little darker in color, and to hold them in contempt because they're not as light as other as the white Jews, I find that very, very interesting. So it's sort of consistent in terms of this kind of contempt they have for the darker Palestinian brothers and sisters. So this question in terms of color or colorism, you know, it speaks volumes. And unfortunately, because a lot of us have brought into this Western analysis around history, we tend to believe that color is biologically determinative, and it actually defines who we are in terms of our color. So therefore, we brought into that nonsense. And so therefore, even in the context of people who say that they're Jewish, who brought into this nonsense in terms of color defines your terms of who you are, your value, your importance, and so forth and so on. So it's very, very funny, you know, that these people incorporate this kind of colorist thinking, and in the same token, talk about the fact that they're guided by religion. But anyway, I conclude with that.
Thank you, Brother Haki. Brother Moses, one of the issues that were raised in this discussion was the issue of how do you take someone else's land and give it to someone else and then talk about sharing it. How do you overcome that type of contradiction? What's your take on this particular documentary, Brother Moses?
Thank you, Brother Africa. In the struggle for freedom and justice, we demand equal rights and justice. And therefore, you know, when the Jews came to Palestine, they started buying up the land and driving off the Palestinians. You know, there was no equal rights and justice involved. It was just the chauvinism and arrogance of the Jews. And so, you know, right now the Palestinians need control over their land, and the government controls the land, controls the economy, and controls the rights of the people. And so participating in the government, it becomes vital to freedom if you're going to be able to enjoy the fruits of the society. And so, you know, it's a collective problem and must be dealt with as a collective problem, that equal rights and justice for all people in the land. The Palestinians first have the right to self-determination, because these Jews just came in and took over, and they political power flows from the barrel of a gun, as Mao Zedong said. So these Jews, you know, gain political power through the gun. And, you know, there is no just society. It's just for Jews, by Jews, and with Jews only, in terms of the government and pursuing the interests of the people. And so, you know, the struggle is, it's just like in the USA, they're trying to deny us the vote, just like they want to deny the Palestinians the vote, because that will give them power. That will give them the right to determine what goes on in that land. And they don't want people to have power, you know. And there's a lot of pseudo intellectuals who reinforce that ideology. And so, you know, we have to struggle for equal rights and justice. Thank you.
Thank you, Brother Moses and Sister Eleanor. You can tell that all the time, eventually the truth told one time, we are crashed and lie told many times. And this narrative is a narrative that very, very rarely hear in the national media, as Brother Ivan Slane discussed this whole question of Arab Jews and his hidden history. Will you give us your critique of what you have listened to so far, Sister Eleanor?
The Zionism is a form of racism. We see apartheid in Palestine. And as the brother said, as the speaker said, you know, the whole concept of racism was a Western concept, and this polarization of the Jews. Jews live throughout the world, not only in Asia and the Arab world, but in China and in Africa, in Nigeria and Ethiopia, and as he said, Algeria, Morocco, Jewish people, but non-white Jews, besides the Ashkenazi, who are very light-skinned, live throughout the world. And they traveled from the east to the west. And much of what we know about the Jewish world as well as the pre-colonial world is written in Arabic. And we find it in the libraries of Spain. So I had the privilege of knowing a woman named Dolores Fleming who had studied in Spain, and her PhD studies were in women's studies, the study of women and the struggle of women. But in doing that, she began to realize that everything we knew about religion before the Western world advanced was all written in Arabic. So that's one thing that I thought the guy mentioned that was very interesting. And Jewish people, Palestine was had many more Christians and Palestinians converted to Islam out of the oppression of Palestinian people. And the division that we see in the Middle East is the result of Zionism, not of Judaism, not of Islam, not of Christianity, but as a matter of Zionism and the European occupation of Palestine. The fact that it's a military settler state and it has created so much conflict, the conflict that we see, much of the conflict we see in the Near East, or as it's called, the Middle East, as a result of the Zionist state and its occupation and expansion, taking a bit of Egypt, you know, and it's military occupation. When we saw in 1948 or 49, the Zionists line up women and children on a wall and shoot them dead, that remained a mark in the minds of all around the world. And the idea of, as Brother Moses said, Palestinians can't vote in Israel. No one can vote in Israel except for Jews. Christians cannot vote. Muslims cannot vote. Just Jews. And this leaves these people without a voice. If you can't vote, you can't run candidates. So you remain invisible. And this concept of the two-state solution can't work where the entire second state or first state, as the Palestinians should be called, do not have the privilege of voting in the Zionist settler state. So we've seen in the last 40 years these 30-foot walls. We've seen a form of genocide where husbands and wives of a certain age are separated from each other and can't meet. Therefore, they cannot have children. We've seen all of these things. We've seen the wall go up, and it literally went right through Palestinian land and separated animals from the herd. You know, they didn't mind if they separated calves from their mothers. You know, it didn't matter. It just was construction, and it was intended to be psychologically violent and physically violent, and it has been. And the reality is that when we see Israeli TV in the West, they don't show the dark-skinned Jews. They are also there, and they bought the falashes from Ethiopia maybe 40 years ago to Israel, but they seem to be relatively disenfranchised. But one thing, through visual documentation, you got to see was their aggression towards Palestinians. So they may have only spoke Amharic, but the language of hatred is prevalent in Israel, as you saw the falashes jumping on the Jewish houses as they were being destroyed by bulldozers. Now, racism, as we know it today, is a Western concept, and it's prevalent, and as Haiki had mentioned, you know, and the Zionists bring it up all the time that their struggle is very similar to, quote, the U.S. struggle, in that in the U.S. They annihilated the nations. In the United States, they annihilated the nations, the tribal nations. But two wrongs don't make a right. And the reality is the world learned how horrible what the colonialists did, the Spaniards, the English, and the French, what they did in the Americas, how horrible it was. And that it should have never be duplicated again. And we lost so much knowledge in destroying the peoples of North and South America and the Caribbean. So for the Zionists to duplicate that in Palestine is outrageous. And this murder of the Palestinian people is worse than it seems worse, and I may be wrong, than the Holocaust, the Nazi Holocaust. We don't know really whether it's 40,000 people dead or 92,000, because the people telling the story are not the people that are oppressed. And they killed so many journalists. The Israelis have killed so many journalists until there's no one to tell the story. And they started off their war. They started off their occupation. It's really not a war. The expansion of their occupation on October 7th, 2023, with the bombing of news media stations, of their satellites, letting them know, get out of their building, and they destroyed the the press building and all of these things, and they've marched on from Gaza City. I guess I don't know which direction they've marched, but they have continued to murder and destroy everything in Gaza.
All right, Sister Eleanor, we have to stop you right here. What we're going to do right now, we're going to take a Robert Sherry Carter break. This is my 65th birthday. And when we come back, we have each one of y'all 2 minutes or less give us your final thoughts on today's program. This is Brother Africa. He's celebrating and honoring his 65th birthday. And we'll be right back. This is Africa on the Move.
Water in chains, living in pain. Today is the same, and nothing ever changes. Oh, my news, can't tell the truth. Filled with abuse, and everywhere there's danger. How long can this go on? When will the light I see? I know I must be strong to last through my journey. Yes, to last through my journey. Yes. We must decide to get off the ride and stop going through these changes. We must prepare and learn how to care, for soon we'll be there where our lives won't be in danger. And when the light is clear, oh how beautiful I will be, to know that I've been here and made it through my journey, yeah, and made it through my journey, yeah, 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 made it through my journey, made it through my journey.
Hello, Reno. A bloodline across the waters, from Benin to Salvador Bahia. A scar across the face of the earth. Palarino, the place they brought the Africans, the place where they tried to make them slaves. Palarino! You can feel the whip, hear the cries, and see the blood in the red clay. The clay that holds the stones together is African. And each stone is a bone from a people called slaves. Palarino was the place where death came to dwell. His neighbors did not complain, for he was a way out. From the cold gray cobblestone streets to the lifeless cathedrals, tall walls of demons called angels, haunted visions of white faces crucifying Jesus again and again. But in the sacrifice of this blood, of this dance with death, comes life more rich, more pure, more alive, where death spent many lonely nights pacing the floors of his funeral parlor, waiting for someone to die. Palarino, a French word called the place of torture, became a place of strength, a place where faithful white saints became faces of black gods, where haunted visions and demons became healing visionaries and orishas from the motherland. And Jesus rejoined his kinfolk and was reborn and baptized in the sound of sensual skin turned up to dance, to inspire a fire like the sun, pronouncing his presence. Palarino was the tongue of the flame, licking the eyes of those who tried to remain blind, shining a light on a spirit that would not be denied. No, the chains did not break the spirit, did not enslave the music of my soul, did not shackle the will of my freedom, did not tarnish the glow of my gold. world and all the Pelovinos in Africa, in Europe, in North and South America cannot destroy the majesty of my people, the love of my people, shining like the sun everywhere we go. Everywhere we go. When the light is clear, oh, how beautiful I will be to know that I've been here and made it through my journey, yeah, and made it through my journey, yeah, 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 yeah.
Welcome you back to Africa on the Move as a special edition today on the 27th of July, celebrating and honoring the 65th birthday of Bella Lee. In closing out this particular program today, we will ask our participants to take 2 minutes or less and give us their final thoughts for tonight. First, we'll start with Brother Moses. Your final thoughts for tonight, Brother Moses.
Thank you. Thank you. Thank you, Brother Africa. First of all, we all feel the problem. He who feels it knows it. So, you know, we feel the problem, and so we express the problem in the best we can do, given our understanding of the problem. Some of us understand the problem more than others. We have to build on a sure foundation. That's why I say Jesus is the answer for the world today, from the cursing of the fig tree against the resurrection of Israel to honor your mother and your father by getting married before having a child. All these are guide to action and the way, the truth, and the light. We have to build on a sure foundation. And so, you know, Palestine will be free of the Zionist state. It's just a question of time. It's not a question of if or not. It will be done, because progress is inevitable, because the people will not stop struggling until they are free. And this is the truth that we can rest assured of. The people will not rest until Palestine is free. And I say happy birthday, Brother Lee. Have a good night. Thank you.
Thank you, Brother Moses. You do the same. Sister Eleanor, 2 minutes or less, you'll find a statement.
Happy birthday. Happy birthday, Brother Africa. Happy birthday, Brother Lee Robinson. Just have many, many more, and God bless you. Yeah, you know, the discussion about the third leading cause of deaths in the United States being Dr. Era, leading to 15,000 deaths a month, is important for everyone to examine and realize. Also, you know, it brings up the fact that this country has a whole industry built on nursing homes. And once you hit that 120-day, that 100-day marker, you become a resident often of that nursing home. And they take over your assets. And that it is regulated, the amount of square footage, like 70 square feet per person and this kind of thing. And many of the nursing homes don't have telephones in the room for their clients. It's only been because of recent protests and family protests that inspire, located in DuPont Circle in Washington, D.C., for example, has installed individual phones for their clients. And the quality of life in nursing homes doesn't mean anything. 70 square feet means that in a small room, you can have two persons, two TVs, two phones. Well, nobody thinks about making sure that they have headsets so that they won't disturb their fellow patient. And so, you know, all of this stuff is lending to death. And once you become a resident of a nursing home, you can't leave unless a family member or someone picks you up. It's like a minimum security prison. And so we really need to restructure the medical system in this country. And remember, African-American women have the highest infant mortality in the United States, unless it's changed, in the Western Hemisphere. Our infant mortality rate exceeded that of Haiti. Now, this is an atrocity, but it's nonetheless a fact that infants and mothers die every day, and no one is outraged by this fact. No one is outraged by the fact that elders and disabled persons end up in nursing institutions and disappear every day. But they do. And I would say to all the listeners tonight, if you know someone in a nursing home, give them a call to see how they're doing. Say hello. I would ask them to do that as a gift to Brother Africa, to give anyone you know in a nursing home a call Sunday morning and just say hello. And I'd like to ask all our listeners to please send in your donations to become a monthly donor to Africa on the Move. $10, $25, $100, $150 a month donors will receive a signed reproduction of a artwork by Eleanor Johnson. After you pledge your $150 and maintain that standard of donation for 1 year, you will receive a reproduction of an artwork by Eleanor Johnson. So I'd just like to say to all the listeners, please make your contribution today. And I'd like to say to you, Brother Africa, happy birthday to you and to the fellow analysts and to you, Brother Africa. Thank you for allowing me to participate in this evening's forum. Thank you.
Thank you, Sister.
Good night.
Good night. And we thank you, as always, Sister Eleanor, for your contribution to this program. And thank you for your suggestion of your gift that people could do. Brother Haki, your final thoughts tonight.
Yeah, well, you know, the problem, Brother Africa, is that when we talk about the structural dimensions of this capitalist system, one thing we have to fundamentally understand, according to the Declaration of Independence, people have a right to make profit. And as such, businesses do what they do in the best interest of their bottom line, not the best interest of the people. In that regard, policy, political policy, has no place in terms of telling people how they should run their business. This is a fundamental problem that we're having. So when we talk about voting, if we look around the world, we see where people vote. Many of the people, countries around the world have the same problem we have, even though they vote. So fundamentally, so if we think voting is a solution, then you got to explain to me, why is it in every country in the world people vote, but still
people who are poor and impoverished get the short end of the stick. So is voting really the solution? I think not. I think one of the things that we have to fully understand, when we look at Burkina Faso, Niger, and Mali, and when we talk about these heroic brothers standing up and saying, listen, the fundamental imperialist structure has to be demolished. They're taking a stand. So what they're saying is that what voting can achieve, we can achieve by unilaterally dismantling the imperialist structure. That is what has to happen. In this country, if people don't understand, and particularly in the African community, if people don't understand that the path to true empowerment lies with themselves and not with some exterior entity, we'll continue to be deceived. We think that politicians are going to solve our problems. Politicians are not there to solve our problems. So when you look at it from a systemic point of view, politicians are there to reinforce the running of the system. If they're there to reinforce the running of the system or the elements of the system, then why do you think that they could ever be empowered to actually address the issues, you know, that are pertinent to the masses of people in society? They're not. If the change that we need to see has to come from the people, it's not going to come from voting. And by the way, when we talk about the Electoral College, keep in mind, Electoral College decides who's president, not the popular vote. In other words, people vote do not decide who becomes president of the United States. And I think just as important, I think that in terms of Electoral College, there are 7 states that determine who becomes president of the United States because they have the most electoral votes. So collectively, those 7 states all vote for one candidate. That's who becomes the president of the United States. We have to wake up and realize and start being critical and stop articulating these narratives. It has no real meaning in terms of truth. These are just things that the people in positions of power tell us to internalize because it protects them. It allows them to make, you know, grandiose, ridiculous kinds of statements and not be challenged, because if we believe, in fact, that if voting is the solution to our problems, then all we have to do is articulate voting is the solution. And in reality, we know that voting is not the solution, that the empowerment comes from the people themselves. And if we don't understand that, if people keep persisting that voting is the solution, then they keep voting and nothing ever changes, then you know what? At some point, the system itself is going to get tired of these same people who cast their votes, but who the system itself sees as a privilege, or in other words, the system sees people as a drain on the resources. In other words, something has to be done with all these people who are drained on the resources. We have to understand this is reverse series. And so when we talk about the runaway inflation in society, which is good for wealthy people, when we talk about in terms of the Supreme Court ruling in terms of empowering corporations, when we talk about the Food and Drug Administration powerless to regulate what goes into our food, simply because the Congress has defunded them, or powerful people are paying them to look the other way. When we look at those kind of realities, then it's very, very clear that the situation for oppressed people is becoming perilous by the day. And if we think for one second that voting is going to change those paradigms, then we're not thinking, and we've got to stop that. I mean, really, the situation is very, very critical. But I encourage people to unravel the matrix, because I think that is key. Because if we don't think outside of the box, the reality is that, you know what, people who benefit from the system realize that the system is in default. And because it's in decline, they understand that people who don't have the things they need in society in terms of material things like food, shelter, and education, they realize that they're going to turn against the state. So they're making preparations before even gets to that point to not only to divide people, but to pit people against each other up, to define who's the enemy. So at some point in time, they can encourage groups to actually eliminate those who are perceived as the enemy. We have to understand, when we talk about who is the enemy in the context of American capitalism, I don't think anybody should be surprised that we're talking about African people. You know, of course we can include immigrants, we can include gay people, we can include progressive women. But the bottom line is that someone has to pay the price for the decline of society. voting is not going to prevent the deterioration of this system. We have to understand the fundamental reality is that the problems that we articulate weekly on Africa on the Move is here to stay, and it's getting much more and more pernicious. And we got to understand the implicit threat, and we have to begin to start thinking, because if we don't think and organize and create institutions, then the bottom line is that when things break loose, the problem is it becomes that much more difficult in terms of trying to create some kind of way to devise a strategy to protect yourselves from all kind of mayhem and destruction. This is a problem that we're confronted with, and I think people should think long and hard about this issue in terms of voting, because voting is fine from a strategic point of view in terms of getting people to work together. It's good in that regard. But if you think that there are intimate results from voting, then you're sadly mistaken. And this is the problem that we're having with. So I don't want anybody out there to think that, you know, we endorse the idea that the solution to our problem is voting. We don't want anybody to think that. We want people to understand precisely what the issues are, and that it's incumbent upon them in terms of bringing about the resolution to the problems that they face, and not some politician. Voting is fine strategically, but it's not a panacea. It's not going to protect us from a system that's in decay, and that's the bottom line. So, anyway, Brother Africa, having said that, you have a good birthday, and we'll see you next time.
Thank you, Brother Haki, for your contribution as well to today's program. We're going to end this program with a special tribute and acknowledgement on the transition of a friend and an ally of Africa on the Move, Brother Alberto N. Jones. And we ran across a very excellent presentation of a tribute to him by the All African People Revolutionary Party. We're going to play that, and after that, I'll make a few statements, and we will continue our celebration until tomorrow. So first, let's go and acknowledge the recent transition by our brother Alberto N. Jones, who made his transition on the 12th of July. He was born August the 29th, 1938. When he made the transition, he was 85 years old. This brother really typifies this question of service, suffering, and sacrificing for his people. He's dearly going to be missed. So let's listen to a statement from the APRPGC as they share their condolences to him, his family, and the rest of the world.
July 25th, 2024. All African People's Revolutionary Party, GC, sends its condolences to the family members and friends of Brother Alberto Jones, an Afro-Cuban and a freedom fighter for freedom, justice, equality, liberation, and revolution. Alberto N. Jones, August 29, 1938 to July 12, 2024. It came as a shock and surprise to the All African People's Revolutionary Party, GC/AAPRP, GC, when recently receiving the news that one of our longtime ally and comrade for over 40 years of solidarity, Brother Alberto N. Jones, has made his transition on July 12, 2024, at the age of 85. We send our feelings of sorrow to his family members, friends, and all those who knew him and love him so dearly. We have lost a man of principles, committed to a world of freedom, justice, equality, peace, and revolution. Brother Alberto N. Jones, like all conscious and pan-African revolutionaries, has exemplified one of the 15th rules of discipline by Osachi Ifo Kwame Nkrumah, where his life of expressions and actions can best be understood in his desire to always be the servant of the people. Our brother Alberto also displayed a behavior of recognizing the importance of a strong and powerful nation of peoples of African descent in the West Indies would give a strong fillip to the efforts we in Africa have been making towards the creation of a united Africa. This quotes a letter from President Kwame Nkrumah to the West Indian heads of government, June 7, 1962. Our comrade, Brother Alberto, worked very hard during of his life to help make this statement a reality by being an architect, founder and /or supporter/ally of such organizations as Caribbean American Children Foundation, CACF, in Palm Coast FLA, the West Indian Welfare Society in the city of Guantanamo, Cuba, a writer for Afro-Cuba Web, a recruiter for Latin American School of Medicine, Elam, a builder of the Adams Brook Anglican Center for All Saints Church, Guantanamo, Cuba, while being a fierce warrior against the U.S. blockade against Cuba and a member of the National Network on Cuba, NNOC, the Cuban Solidarity Movement in the U.S., a supporter of Gloria Rolando, Cuban filmmaker, and an ally-slash-friend of the Freedom Ride Challenges to Cuba by the African Awareness Association, Inc., has left Brother Alberto a legacy and track record to be admired. Brother Alberto's love for the unity of his African-Caribbean community, and it needs to unify with Africa and its diaspora, and the attainment of Pan-Africanism is a path that we must continue to strive for until victory has been won. In struggle and a salute to Brother Alberto Jones. All African People's Revolutionary Party, GC, / AAPRP, GC.
And our condolences again go to his family, his loved ones, and all those who was a friend of Brother Alberto N. Jones. We make this urgent appeal, this important appeal, to support the works of Africa on the Move and Brother Africa, Brother Lee, on his 65th birthday. You can make that contribution on a monthly, weekly, or semi-annually basis. You can send it to in care of African Awareness Association, Lee Robinson, P.O. Box 4433, Richmond, Virginia 23220, or you can cash app it by $ capital L, small c, small r, small o, small b, or you can zell it to African Awareness Association 2 at Gmail. We thank you for your support. We want you to share the word that you can hear Africa on the Move every Sunday evening at 7 p.m. At the present time, you might want to send Blog Talk Radio, our family member, a letter to see what can we do to straighten out the problems for why we are having difficulties of not being able for the last several weeks to have the voice of Africa on the Move to be heard on Sunday evenings at 7 p.m. Like always, we strive to go forward, album, backwards, never, and we know what organization all things are possible. To the African community and to African people worldwide, we come to say to you, don't fall for the hype. Africa, African people is not poor. They are not poor. They are just poorly organized. The solution is to get organized. Let's get organized. And to the AAPRPGC, I'd like to give my praise, my respect for them playing a major role on my willingness to engage, to participate, and to understand the necessity to struggle with the people, among the people, and for the people, and my political development. To the AAPRP, AAPRPGC, if you'd like to know more about that organization, which I will highly encourage you to do that, please check out their website at www.a-aprp-gc.org. Now, people need the proper political education in order to move forward. I suggest them, if you don't think they are the solution to our problems, find an organization, join an organization that is doing something to fight for the liberation and unification of your people and for a better humanity to all people. Until next time, we'll see you tomorrow, July 28th at 7 p.m. And like always, we may not give you what you want, but we damn sure will do our best to give you what you need. This is Brother Africa on his 65th birthday, and you've been listening to Africa on the Move, and we can continue to celebrate for the rest of the night. We'll see you tomorrow. Hey. We'll be right back.
I was getting more like baby.
Havana.